So we spend time, first of all, helping to understand what is the vision after an exit? What is it that you want to do with your time, with your resources, with your energy? Helping people visualize what life will be like after exiting the company, often that they've built or been involved with for many, many years, is an important step. And I think important step in just starting to unravel from the identity, that's been built into this experience of building what they've built.
Selling your business may be the single most important financial event of your life, and the process is far more complex, emotional, and impactful than most CEOs realize. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the CEO Coaching International Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Sandusky. My guests today are Brenda Jacobson and Andy Harris. Brenda is a former CEO who successfully sold her own family business, while Andy is a seasoned executive who's led multiple private equity-backed companies through acquisitions and exits. Today, they both serve as managing directors at STS Capital Partners, where they guide entrepreneurs and CEOs through the intricate and often emotional journey of selling their business. In today's conversation, we discuss what it really takes to prepare your company for sale, how to balance running the business while navigating the exit process, and the critical decisions that determine whether you simply get a deal done or achieve a truly extraordinary outcome. In the conversation, Brenda and Andy share why preparing your business as if it could be sold tomorrow makes it stronger today. They talk about the emotional challenges that owners and leadership teams face during the exit process and how to plan for life after the sale. They talk about the difference between strategic and financial buyers and how to find the perfect fit for your company. And they talk about practical steps to maximize valuation, protect your team, and ensure your legacy. With that, please enjoy my conversation with Brenda Jacobson and Andy Harris. Well, we're going to talk about a topic which is near and dear to many entrepreneurs and CEOs' hearts, which is selling the business and the whole exit process, because eventually most folks are going to want to monetize the business in some fashion. So we're going to talk about that whole process here. So let's just start at a high level with what is it really like to be in an exit process? And I know sometimes we might relate it that selling your business is like selling a house, only much bigger. So tell me a little bit about this process.
The first big deal I got to work on was actually a family business that I had helped build up. And, part of what can be challenging about being in the process is how important it is for the business to keep performing while also in a parallel path, putting a lot of hard work into preparing to go to market, being in market, and then ultimately closing. There's certainly a lot of emotional kind of tax of that experience. You can get tired of having to do both. And depending on who on your team is involved, you could be asking a lot of people, who are already putting a lot into the business to keep the operations going. So it's not a commitment that we recommend you take lightly. I think you need to be all in before you make this decision. And I think we'll share some insights around how to prepare for that. But making the decision is one that often can take a great deal of time and future thinking, for someone to really get comfortable with it.
And a lot of business owners, they spent their lives building their business. They know their business inside and out. They know it really well. But many or most have never sold a business before. And so you really don't know what you don't know. And Brenda had the experience of selling a family business and going through that whole process. I had a little bit different experience where I was a hired gun CEO for businesses that were backed by three different private equity firms. So I guess I was kind of fortunate to have private equity behind me. They're very structured, have a great process. And I learned that process. I learned the private equity playbook three times to build a business, doing lots of acquisitions, doing a roll-up, and then from the very first day that a private equity firm buys a business, if it's the platform or whatever, they're thinking about the exit, which is in 3 to 5 to 7 years. So you're working to that, and it's a process from the beginning, let alone the full exit process when you finally decide to go to market. And so it's definitely a process when you're selling your business, and it's something you have to surround yourself with experts and trust the process and trust the experts and It's going to be an emotional roller coaster, that's for sure. But there's light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, Andy, you mentioned you worked for three different PE firms. Did they have three different playbooks, or were they all pretty similar in terms of how they went about the process?
Largely, the process is fairly similar. So some had a more documented formal process and others not as much. But in all the cases, I was very fortunate that the private equity firms also left it up to me and our executive team to build and develop and further refine the playbook to what worked for us and for our uniqueness to our business. And then by the nature of private equity, also Brenda mentioned about the team that needs to be involved. The nature of private equity, our leadership team and key people were bought in to begin with because they have a little bit of sweat equity in the deal. So everybody is aligned, really working hard for that ultimate exit because they get a little bit of something in return. And many times private businesses don't have that, right? So that's another consideration in terms of getting that team aligned as you go through the process.
And Brenda, you had mentioned the importance of continuing to run the business as you're going through this process. And it seems to me that a best practice for CEOs should be that my business should always be ready to be sold, even if I'm not even on the market. That way, hopefully, there's not a big gap between what I need to do to get the business in shape to be sold versus where it is today. So tell me a little bit more about what it's like for the CEO to try and continue to run the business while they're going through the process. I mean, imagining it's still a bit of a strain, even if your business already is ready to sell.
First of all, that's great advice, Steve. I think it's always going to make a business healthier to build it as if you could sell it, whether that's the path you choose or not. The complexity comes in because, you know, a group like ours that's supporting business owners who are ready to step into a selling process, we need a lot of information up front. You know, we're getting to know the company in a way that we're going to be able to position it in a really attractive light for a wide net that we want to cast around potential strategic buyers. And so there's a lot of upfront information that's needed for that. The CFO role is actually kind of one of, I feel like, the pressure points, because even with really tight financials, there's going to be a huge demand on that person to provide a lot of information as we prepare for going to market. We also like to pre-populate what we expect we'll be needing through diligence. So that's an additional workload. And I think when I was CEO and starting to sell, it was easy to become captivated by the process because that was a new thing for me at that point. And I could take my eye off the ball of running the business. We want businesses to be sellable without the founder or the business owners to be a critical part of its ongoing success. So hopefully, you know, the founders or entrepreneurs have started to take a step back and they can be extracted from the business easily. But someone needs to be keeping their eye on continued performance. A growing business is going to be more attractive to one that might be stabilizing or maybe even dropping off. And so I think the balance of an additional workload on top of roles that probably already can feel maxed out at times, that's where it gets to be tricky, Steve. Especially as Andy pointed out, if there isn't transparency around a process starting within the company. Because, you know, we work with some clients where their senior leadership team is on board, they're even incentivized. But we've also worked in situations where not everybody's aware that a decision's been made to sell. So it's those complexities can make it even more burdensome on some individuals who are in the know, while others might be just focused on running the business because they're not aware of a transaction.
You mentioned that a lot of the CEOs or the owners have actually stepped back, and so the business can to some extent run without them. What do you find in most of these transactions in terms of, do the founders tend to stick around for 6 to 12 months or 2 or 3 years after the fact? Or is it pretty much sell and leave? I would imagine it's going to vary, but what is sort of the typical experience there?
Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. What we do on this show is we find the world's leading entrepreneurs and CEOs, and we spend about a half hour with them and really dig into their story. We want to understand the strategies and the tips and the tools that they use to make big happen in their business. And by the end of each episode, you'll have actionable ideas that you can implement on your path to big success. To learn more about CEO Coaching International and how we can help you dramatically grow your business, visit us at CEOCoachingInternational.com.
It's going to depend on the buyer and the circumstance. And many times, what does the owner want? Some owners want to leave, right? So we've got to find a buyer that is a really good fit for that and may not necessarily need them. But all buyers at least want them to stick around for some reasonable transition period. It could be 6 months to 12 months as a minimum. Other sellers would desperately want to stay involved. They don't want to leave it yet. They're just wanting to take some chips off the table. Maybe they want to bring a partner in that will help them further scale and grow the business faster than they would be able to do otherwise. So it depends first and foremost, I think, on the purpose and the why of the owner. What do they want to achieve? And then really running a really great strategic process to find the great strategic fit that complements that outcome. And at the end of the day, all owners want their business to fall into a good home, right? Very few just say, I just want the biggest check and I don't care who it is. You rarely hear that, right? They always want it to fall into a good home. So, and then I think you're highlighting on a little bit earlier about the leadership team, but to build a leadership team that's built for the long run, that can scale the business, that can lead the business, and that's going to play well with whatever the buyer is. Even if the buyer has their own leadership team and they're not going to need your leadership team, so to speak, they're going to probably top grade, and there'll be some give and take as they integrate the companies, and the best people in the positions usually will stay. But you need to at least be in the position where the buyer has that optionality, because many buyers, and if we find the right buyer, they desperately need the leadership team. They need the business. They want the business. And it doesn't matter whether it's a financial or strategic buyer.
I've seen situations where the seller of the company, let's say they're the founder, they're going to get the biggest check out of this. So they're going to be financially fine. But then they've got a leadership team that's been with them for many, many years. They have a strong attachment to them, and they want to make sure that the leadership team is taken care of after the sale. But I've seen situations where there's a little bit of remorse on the seller's part that they didn't do a good enough job having strong enough protections in for their leadership team after the sale in terms of them getting taken care of. A, have you seen that too? And B, what can the seller of the company, the founder, what can they do to help ensure that their leadership team that's been very loyal to them for many, many years get taken care of after the sale if they're the ones who are actually going to be sticking around after the sale?
Since you never know exactly what's going to happen after a deal closes, a lot of our clients are starting to think really intentionally about a financial incentive for that management team at close. So, you know, our sellers can control what they can control. They can't ultimately control things after the deal closes, even if they stay involved. In most cases, they're not going to be stepping into a role that would be able to directly influence the experience of their team, but they can control being willing to give them a piece of the exit, you know, so to say. And I think more and more of our clients are thinking very proactively about that. That also gives them the opportunity to open up the conversation and to be very transparent about going through a process. Because as Andy said before, with his leadership teams in the PE world, when everybody's aligned financially, you know, with an incentive that feels like everyone can win, it can make some of those hard days, I think, easier to overcome. So we're seeing a lot of our clients actually take that on as part of their proceeds rather than relying on the experience being positive after closing. You do your best. If we have clients who say that's an important part of our outcome, we're going to do our best to find that ideal fit. But because you never know what the future holds, they also can add in a financial incentive at closing that helps set up that management team member that's been around for a while, that's helped them get into this position to sell and to be attractive, give them some options, you know, so staying doesn't have to be the only decision that they make.
What I've seen with many clients, they'll do that in a couple of different ways. One, it can just simply be a special payroll that occurs at close where certain employees get a bonus, right? That comes out of company cash before closing. Others, they actually will create some type of a phantom equity or stock program and give them some equity interest in the company. So they're getting something that way. So that would be for the employees at close. And the other thing that I always try to do is advocating on behalf of the company and on the employees, especially for key employees that are needed going forward. We'll talk to the buyer and make sure the buyer understands who are those key employees. And many times get them set up with stay bonuses. The buyer will say, hey, we desperately need these people to stay on. If they stay on with us for a year, they get a bonus. There's an integration that has to occur, certain milestones of that integration, maybe they'll get bonus. So I'll try to advocate on behalf of our client and their employees to the buyer for that. And then it does also depend if it's a strategic buyer or a financial buyer. A financial buyer is backed by private equity. By nature, they're going to want to give some sweat equity to at least key employees. So they will now be engaged and aligned and motivated to help grow the business under their private equity ownership. So if it's a private equity buyer, that is usually a component, at least for key employees. And strategic buyers can set up some types of management incentive programs as well. And if they're backed by private equity, then of course they'll put in the standard private equity program.
You mentioned a strategic buyer versus a financial buyer. I think this would be a good time to really talk about that. So what is the difference between those two types of buyers? And when does it make sense for a seller to look for a strategic buyer versus a financial buyer?
A strategic buyer really is one that is not backed by a private equity or financial sponsor, right? It could be a private family business, or it could be a publicly held strategic, as you may think of. And the way STS runs our processes, when we engage with our client and help our client get prepared to go to market and then take their business to market, we're going to reach out to the buyers that we believe are going to look at the business strategically. And some of those will be businesses that they're a great strategic fit. And a strategic fit means both businesses can be transformed by the combination. And that transformation, the ideal transformation, is when growth is impacted for both companies. They both do better because of the combination. And when you get that kind of integrated strategic value or transformation, that's when it's a strategic fit and there's a strategic buyer coming in to make that happen. They need the business for a reason, and they can also do something to the business. So it could be a pure strategic, which is not backed by a financial sponsor. It could be a public company or family held business, or it could be backed by private equity. So just because something's backed by private equity doesn't mean it's not a strategic buyer. And in my case, when I was running businesses that were backed by private equity, we were doing strategic roll-ups and creating great value by doing that. And then there's pure financial buyer, which is a buyer that maybe there's no strategic value that's created. They're just coming in and buying it for financial value. And then maybe they can do some things to add to it. They'll then become a strategic buyer of other businesses if they're going to do a roll-up, or they may have some unique expertise or whatever that they can impact the strategy of the business as it goes forward. But to begin with, out of the gate, there's real no strategic value that's immediately created because of the combination of two businesses.
So there's going to be situations where a buyer is buying the company because they want to keep the brand of the company that they're buying, and they want to basically let it operate as it's been operating, but maybe they've got additional capital so they can turbocharge the growth, but it's just going to be sort of as is, but we're going to accelerate everything. And then there might be another buyer who says, hey, I just want your client list, or I'm going to take your business and I'm going to merge it into one of our existing lines, and your brand is going to go away and it's going to be as if it never existed before. So as a seller, those are two really different alternatives for me and for my ego and for my legacy. So how do you counsel those? And let's say the one where my brand goes away and my legacy goes away, they're offering me dramatically more money for that. So how do you counsel a seller around the trade-offs between keeping my legacy and what I built versus I'm going to get a much higher check if I forget about all that?
One of the ways we do that, because it's a great question, Steve, and I think a situation we run into often, we have a very intentional step before we've even prepared the materials to go to market. And it's an exercise that we call required and preferred outcomes. So we spend time, first of all, helping to understand what is the vision after an exit? What is it that you want to do with your time, with your resources, with your energy, helping people visualize what life will be like after exiting the company, often that they've built or been involved with for many, many years, is an important step, you know, and I think important step in just starting to unravel from the identity, you know, that's been built into this experience of building what they've built. It also helps us have that conversation because there are situations where having the identity of the company remain may be a required outcome, and it gives us an opportunity to talk through the trade-offs that would exist in that situation. The more limiting that the process is around who would be okay to buy the company, you know, assuming that they would hit that financial threshold that's necessary, the less likely we are then to create a bidding environment that would maximize enterprise value. So we are really, really intentional about having those conversations early on in our process, sometimes before we even take on a client, because if a situation were to present where the limitations are so strong that we don't really think we can run a fulsome process, then we can have that conversation, you know, before we've made a commitment to each other. Oftentimes, when you start to explain what those limitations impose, we see a loosening of the attachment to that requirement. Instead, it's more about the lasting impact, let's say, or what that higher value would enable the founder or business owner to do. You know, if there's a very strong purpose towards something that maybe legacy can be left in a different way, I guess is the easiest way to say it. So we talk through those things and can share our experiences. We even have client testimonials that address that because it is a big part of making the decision to sell or not and when to sell or not. And we are careful to pay attention to those details because it will guide us in who we include in our outreach and become then a filter in which we evaluate potential buyers and opportunities throughout the process.
To add to that, Steve, to your point, if someone had a brand or a legacy that they absolutely did not want to see go away, one of their required outcomes is, I don't want it touched, right? Then we're going to find buyers that would love to have the brand and love to take that legacy to the next level. And it might be a buyer that's not in the same space, right? Because if they were in the same space, they'd want to smash the brands together and change it. Maybe we have to go to an adjacency, a complementary segment that 1+1=4, and they desperately love to see the brand and legacy survive. So there's part of that matchmaking. We had a client a year and a half ago, live events business, and the founder absolutely wanted the brand to stay. It was not to be discussed. And his legacy was very, very, very important to him and his wife. And so there were two very big strategics in the space that would love to have bought his company, but he absolutely knew they, the minute they buy it, my brand's going away and they're just going to smash us. They're going to just smash us into them. And so he said, I will not sell to them. You're not allowed to outreach to them, right? We didn't, but we found other great buyers and found a really great fit where the business is really thriving now. And actually his son was second generation, was running it and is continuing to run it. So we'll find those outcomes.
Yeah. And I think this idea of attachment and identity with the business that I built is obviously it's super strong. It's just going to be human nature. So have you run into many situations where there's been a bit of a, let's call it a seller's remorse, where they thought they could detach themselves from the business and yet they sell it and now they're just like completely lost. It's like, I don't know what to do. I sold my baby and now what am I going to do? So have you run into that much? And if so, is there like something that they wish they would have done differently or wish they would have known prior to the sale that would have eased this identity crisis after the sale?
I'll start with my dad, Steve. So
okay.
he's pretty willing to admit that his identity of being the physician that founded a very successful, large, privately held practice, that it was tough. Because for days after we closed, he just wasn't needed the same way. And he wasn't invited to speak at events with the same cadence. He didn't get asked to reengage with his association, you know, which he'd been involved with for a long time. I think it took the company to buying his group of clinics the offer of paying him a very small amount of money to be a staff physician in one of the clinics that kind of got him to wake up and realize that he had this amazing opportunity to just re-pivot and focus his time and attention on things that he never had the time or space for. But I think it took him a good year to get there. And I wish that I had met STS at that point, because I hadn't. I think this visioning exercise that we do is such an important part of starting to picture. It's not the same as being in the moment, right? The deal's closed, the money's in the bank. You want to be excited, but you feel this sense of loss and kind of, who am I? But I think it really starts to help someone picture what's going to be important to me in this next phase. And that can be anything. That can be a charity, that can be family, that can be things that you didn't have time or space for before. And I think that helps a lot, but it's a good example of just, it was 35 years that he had built the business that we ultimately sold. And just as an aside, it was two strategic buyers competing. 6 months later, the bigger of the two bought the smaller one. And the people we were dealing with didn't know that. So a competitive process wouldn't have existed if we had waited. I know timing is always kind of a big question as far as, when do I sell? You know, what's the optimal time? No one could have ever predicted it. It was great fortune, you know, that we made that decision to be on the path. And that consolidation happened 6 months later. But it was really tough for him for a minute. But I just want to report out, he's doing fine now. His golf game has gotten a lot better, and he's been able to focus on things he didn't have time for before.
Now, were you involved in the business before it was sold?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about the next of kin here. It's like, how was your transition in this process?
Well, I knew that I was selling myself out of a job. I had been CEO for 8 or 9 years at that point, and I knew that I did not need to become the CEO of these new companies. That wasn't part of the offer. But what I feared was some market conditions that would have forced us to pivot in a way we couldn't have. And the competition, we'd had a really strong moat for more than a decade. There were a lot of competing groups coming in, hospital groups that didn't need to make money the way we did. They were supported by, you know, what those referrals would lead to within the broader health system. We didn't have that benefit. So I just started to see the writing on the wall that we weren't going to be more valuable, and it ended up being the ideal timing. But it did create a moment for me then to figure out what I was going to do next. So I stepped into another role, but I had to get over that before I brought the opportunity to my dad. So I was able to reconcile it quickly.
I have two to kind of contrast a little bit there. First, going back to that live events business, that deal took almost 2 years. And it was an emotional roller coaster. And I would say there were at least 5 times that the founder said, I'm not selling. And he finally ended up selling. And it was the owner's outcome exercise that we did at the beginning with him and his wife that finally just gave him relief and grounding at the end to say, you're right. I remember why I did this. I'm doing it. We're going into our golden years. And our son's going to continue with the business. And this is exactly what we wanted to see happen, and have touched base with them and the son, and things are great. But getting there, he had seller's remorse without even selling it before it even happened, right? There was another one, and it was a CEO coaching client, named Jonathan, that he, by design, we did the owner's outcome exercise with him, but he was determined to sell the business and really needed to, because he has a daughter with special needs that he wanted to dedicate his time to her, and he couldn't be in the business. And so that was his required outcome. I have to exit. And we sold his business for a really great outcome, actually twice what he thought the business was going to go for and what market was. So really got a great outcome. I still stay in touch with him, and we're writing a book together actually on this, but he loves it. I mean, he's just like, that was the best thing I ever did. It transformed my life. Back to what Brenda said, having that owner's outcome exercise at the beginning, going through the required and preferred outcomes, and what does it life look like after the sale? Getting clarity on that ahead of time helps avoid seller's remorse. But I think you're always going to have some of it, right? Especially if it's your baby you've been working with for your whole life.
There are buyers out there who may not necessarily play by the rules or divulge all the information during the buying process. And so there are less reputable buyers out there and there are more reputable buyers out there. So have you ever run into a situation, I'll just like give you an example, where the buyer's intentions were not necessarily to buy the business, but more just to get some intel on a potential competitor? And how do you do your due diligence on potential buyers to make sure that these are legit buyers who have an honest interest in the company that you're representing and making sure that you're finding a good home for them?
A key part of our process when we engage with buyers is, first of all, we're doing due diligence on them as much as they're doing due diligence on our client. And I think because of like Brenda's background as a prior CEO and my background as a prior CEO for private equity, we kind of have, I think, a different sense of we're not just there to get a deal done. We're really there to get a great strategic fit for our client and that their business falls into a good home. At the end of the day, that's our purpose. That's what we want to do and get maximum valuation and all the required and preferred outcomes for our client. So I think you can kind of sense that. And buyers have to convince us why they are the best buyer for the business. Why are they a good home for the business? What are their intentions with the business? And if they're not answering those questions in sincere, authentic ways, you kind of just get a sense. The other thing, Steve, that some buyers do, they want to buy the business. And there are some financial buyers that happens. We had a client where a private equity firm had come in, a very reputable one based in New York, came into the business, knocked on the door, said, we really want to buy your business. The owners didn't know any better. And in this case, the PE firm said, we'll give you 7.5x EBITDA. And that was more money than these guys ever thought they'd have anyways. And they took the offer and they wanted to stay on. So this wasn't a bolt on. This would have been the platform. So the two owners would be able to stay on and continue running it. 8 months later and 3 weeks prior to closing, the PE firm said, we can't give you 7.5x EBITDA. We can only give you 6 because of what we learned in due diligence. And the reasons they stated they knew about the whole time. There was a little bit of a disingenuous retrade at the last minute thinking they're going to agree to this. Well, these guys said, if we're going to stay on, you're going to be our partner. We don't want to deal with somebody that acts that way. So deals off, we're not doing it. They engaged with STS through a webinar that we had had at the time. We took them to market, ran a full process, and invited this PE firm into the process as well. The PE firm bid 8x.
Yeah, that'll teach them a lesson.
Yeah, okay. So they bid 8x and we ended up selling it to a strategic buyer at 12.5x. And this business was in plastic injection molding for medical device. And they got bought by a very, very large plastic injection molding firm, but it was all automotive. So it was a strategic combination by diversifying the businesses. And the two were actually at different ends of the scale of what they did and what they did really well. So it was a great strategic fit. Our two owners got to stay on. They led the medical device division. And they were also then able to offer their medical device customers big contract manufacturing from a massive one if they had huge volumes to be done. So it was a great strategic fit. And our owners avoided the retrade and actually ended up doing almost twice better than they thought they were going to do so.
Well, that's a great example there of the value that a firm like yours adds in the selling process. So how do you guys go about finding the buyers? Like, do you have an example of a situation where you found the perfect fit for the seller and that perfect fit was like on nobody's radar before the process started? So how do you go about finding these perfect fit buyers for the folks you represent?
I think that happens more often than not, Andy. But yeah, it's a great question, Steve. We think very expansively and very creatively about any possible interest that could be tied to what makes this opportunity unique. So the financial performance is kind of the baseline. That's what we use, I think, to make the opportunity attractive. But we quickly shift to speak about what we call Rembrandts in the attic, but there are these special attributes that when combined with another company really create that exponential value that Andy's talked about. We have a whole process that we run internally, but then also with our clients that's called mind mapping. And we generally create a list that's quite expansive. And it's not all of the kind of typical industry players that someone would say, well, this would be who I would think would buy me because they're in a similar space. They're larger than me. They would have the cash. Our focus is also always including an international component of outreach because there can be very attractive attributes for buying a business that's, say, located, let's say, in the United States, but that wouldn't benefit a buyer that's in the United States. So we leverage that creativity. And then our firm, we have, Andy and I are in the role of managing director. We have about 35 people in that role. We have an extensive, broader network of over 5,000 advisors. And those are connection points that we can leverage to get a high level entry interest into a potential buyer so that our opportunities don't go into a general email box that's, you know, where thousands of other opportunities are coming in and could easily be overlooked or never even looked at. We're going in and spending the time and effort to get a high level C-suite, ideally, connection or even board level connection where this becomes something that generates excitement at a senior level, someone that can make a decision, and that's driven down through the organization, you know, rather than hoping it percolates up to the top, you know, and gets the attention we want it to. So our process can maybe take a little longer than some others in the space, but it's because of this tremendous effort to get the opportunity in front of a very expansive, creative list of potential buyers that could be, you know, over 150, 200, depending on the deal.
And it will achieve a premium on value and in some cases an outlier. And I think there's a bit of a fallacy or a lot of sellers think I need to go with an industry specialist that knows my industry, knows the buyers in my industry to get the deal done. And very likely they're going to get the deal done, right? The challenge with that is the seller is going to potentially leave a lot of money on the table because that industry specialist is going to get an industry deal done with the buyers that they know and they know very well. So they're conflicted. They're working for the seller, but they're also helping the buyer get something that they want. And they'll get a good industry deal done, but it's going to be at industry market value, maybe a little bit of a premium if there's some special strategic fit there. But if the buyer would be willing to pay twice as much, that industry specialist isn't going to very likely get that to happen. They're going to get it at what the industry value is and say, hey, we got a great deal done. The buyer's happy, seller's happy. We're moving on to our next transaction instead of taking a little bit extra time to either get that buyer to go up to where it could go. Or maybe they've totally not even thought about adjacent segments because they're only focused on the industry. And that's where you can get real outlier value. I think STS, one of the probably most famous deals that STS did, there was a logistics company in Canada that was a warehouse and they were kind of at the crossroads of two of the main railroads in Canada. And it was a logistics business. So ran the process, went out to a lot of logistics companies. The ultimate buyer was the port of Singapore. They saw a vision, strategic vision of having an inland port versus a port at Port of Vancouver, which was so landlocked and already backed up. So they said, we'll just get the goods off inland where two railroads cross. We'll have the land and the warehouses there. And now we control all that. So it was a really great strategic outcome from an outlier that no one ever would have thought of, right? No one would have ever thought of reaching out to the port of Singapore for us.
But you guys did.
Did. And Steve, we're also thoughtful. A lot of times we're meeting clients, and this is, I think, the case with a lot of CEO, CI clients, where they're running businesses that are growing quickly. They start to get the attention of a potential buyer. And without engaging with a firm like ours, they just start to get inbound interest, right? I've got a client that I just signed up from your community, and he had been approached a number of times by financial buyers who have said, you know, here's an LOI. We want to buy quick. I think when Andy talked about the intentions of a strategic versus a financial buyer, a lot of times the financial buyers are hoping that they don't pick a firm like ours to represent them because they don't want us to run a process that is as fulsome as ours.
It'll cost them a lot more money.
Yeah, it'll cost them a lot more money. But, you know, in the sense of with this client, it's really important to him to maintain the integrity of those relationships. So we will make sure to include those groups in our outreach, but they won't have the exclusivity that they were looking for in the conversations. You know, they'll need to come to the table with something that's attractive enough to kind of keep their seat throughout the process.
Now, when I was running companies, once again, backed by private equity, we always did good deals. They were always fair. They were good. They were industry deals, right? And in the industry I was in, at the size of deals that we were doing, it was 5 to 7 times EBITDA was kind of the market. And that's what we were paying. And many times, 7 times, and the owner thought, man, I got the upper end of industry range. I'm thrilled. We knew we were going to sell, once we did the roll-up, we were going to sell at 9 or 10 times, or maybe even more. So if we could buy it 5 to 7 and sell at 9 or 10, we're making money. As long as we don't screw the business up, we're making money. But then you do other things to improve the business and build more value, and then you make even more money. We always tried to get buyers to go one-on-one with us, right? We didn't want to have an advisor in between. Yeah. And of the 20-some acquisitions I did, only one was in a process. All of the others were proprietary. Now, had those sellers, we were a great home for their business. We treated them well, their employees well, and the business went on to be more, and we achieved their outcomes. Had they pushed hard and said, you know what? I need 8 times or 9 times, our models would have allowed that. So from a 5 to a 7 to an 8 or a 9, that's a 30% increase in value. We would have done it. They just didn't know any better because they thought they were getting a good industry deal. And they rolled over. They had a second bite. They made money on the back end too, but they could have made more money on the front end as well, is my point. Especially if they're selling to us, somebody is looking at them strategically.
We've touched on this just a little bit, but I'd love to get a list of what are the most important things that a seller can do to prep their business to try and get the highest valuation? So if you could give me a list, like here's the number one most important thing that you can do, number two, number three, and then how far in advance should the seller be working on this stuff to make sure that when they are ready to go to market, that they are primed to get the highest price from the best buyer?
Maybe there's not a 1, 2, 3, Steve, because there are a couple at the top. Yeah. But I know one of the most important is having your financials in order. If we're not working with a client that has had audited or reviewed financials, we're typically trying to convince them because it's in their best interest and will pay for itself and then some, but to engage in a quality of earnings. So something to validate, you know, and having an outside firm validating that the financials that we'll go to market with are sound. And then on an ongoing basis, having a strong CFO, if that's the role, but someone who is keeping the books really tight and that kind of in the moment can produce reliable financials is very important. With some of our clients, we're actually bringing in outside CFO help in the process. That's something that I've done a lot more of recently that's been a huge relief for both the client, but also for our team, because we are so dependent on getting that information and having it be in a format that is going to hold up under scrutiny. So the financials being strong and in order and reliable is top 1, 2, or 3.
I would agree that it's definitely in the top 3. Bringing in a fractional CFO is a really good best practice for some companies, maybe if they're a little smaller. They've got a good controller, they've got a good bookkeeper, maybe they've got a good manager of accounting, but they just haven't run a process before. Bringing in a fractional CFO, and in the CEO coaching community, they have a partner preferred CFO, which is a great option for that. The way that's conveyed to a buyer is the buyer is like, okay, hey, you've got a professional CFO who's going to run the process, and your bookkeeper, accounting team, or whatever, they're going to keep running the business. So they're okay with it. And they understand that the CFO is only there to get them through the process. The cost of that CFO is an add back. It's not going to be included in the EBITDA calculation. So I do agree 100% with Brenda. I think the other thing is, and this to me might be number one, if there is any founder risk, if the founder is the business, taking care of that, making sure there is a really good second level leadership team that's running the business on a day-to-day basis. If a buyer perceives that the minute that founder is no longer owner of the business or maybe no longer involved with the business, that that business is at significant risk, you've got to take care of that. That to me is probably the number one thing.
I agree.
So an inverse correlation there between the more valuable the one person is to the business, the less valuable the business is.
Exactly. And even if they want to stay on and say, I'm staying on, I want to take this thing forward, you still need to minimize it because the buyer's thinking, well, what if, you know,
they're going to die someday.
Or they just decide I'm going to the Caribbean, whatever. Right. Or something happens to them, God forbid, right. You know, a buyer needs to mitigate that risk. So I think that's one of the biggest things to do and build out that leadership team. Right. Make sure you've got a great sales leader, a great ops leader, a great technology leader, good finance team. The systems and processes are in place. If businesses have recurring revenue or subscription revenue, really getting that locked in and make it as contractual as you can. That's a huge driver of value for SaaS type businesses or any type of subscription recurring revenue business. And if you can shift your business to that, getting that shift well underway would be a really good thing to do as well.
It's always helpful to show a growing business, Steve. And if you can show that you're growing faster than the industry, that's typically a moment that can present where selling could be, you know, that timing could be right. It's impossible to predict the timing. And I know we get a lot of questions around how do I know when it's the optimal moment to sell? It's difficult. We can make some generalizations, you know, about that. But if you're growing faster than your competitive base and you've been able to outpace your competitors for a number of years, that's going to probably put you in a position of strength to be more attractive, you know, within your industry. You might even start to get some inbound interest. Inbound interest is sometimes a good sign, you know, that there's your industry's hot or there's some specific interest in, you know, what makes your business unique. But those things are also always helpful. It's not helpful to go into a sale process if your business is declining or losing money. You know, that's just going to make it really tough for us to feel like we can get the most for it. And that your other question was, is how far in advance? You know, we're sometimes talking to clients or potential clients years in advance.
Yes.
Giving us some time, you know, a group like ours, some time to be able to learn enough about the company, identify some areas of potential weakness or opportunity, things that we can focus on and help businesses tweak before they get into market. Our process can take 6 to 9, even 12, as Sandy pointed out, sometimes 24 months, we never know. So having a bit of advance notice gives us a great opportunity to work with businesses to kind of get them into the optimal spot, you know, before you go to market.
And most processes are 6 to 9 months. The one I said 24 months, that was deal straight, a totally different example, but most are 6 to 9. I don't want people thinking it's going to go 24. Hopefully not. Yeah.
Well, but sometimes with the environment changing the way it has, you know, some of our deals have had to be paused because, you know, tariffs have impacted some businesses or some opportunities adversely. Some it's been helpful. So there are at times market conditions that are beyond anybody's control that can influence timing. But yes,
right.
6 to 9 is the typical.
And Brenda, a minute ago, you mentioned industries that are hot. So I can't end this conversation without asking about artificial intelligence. So what are you seeing in terms of the businesses that you work with? Are they trying to find a way to incorporate AI into their business so that they can go to market and say, hey, we're using AI and we're going to get a higher valuation? I mean, we don't want to try and fake people in terms of what we're doing with AI, but what are you starting to see in terms of AI? Is that doing anything to the valuations? Are you finding companies that have legitimately integrated AI into their business and demonstrated results with that they're getting significantly higher valuations? Or what's the role of AI in deals these days?
If you have a technology backbone that you now are augmenting with AI, it makes a difference. It's going to help you get a premium. It's starting to kind of become just something that people also expect because it's been relatively straightforward and very fast for a lot of businesses to add that to what they're doing. If you're one of the companies that is bringing that AI to them, those are very hot and you're the one bringing that solution to them. I would also say ancillary to that AI, let's talk data centers, right? I have a client right now that their backlog is, they're quoting end of 27 for their deliveries. They build systems and their ancillary systems that support data centers. So they're not the IT company in the data center. They're enclosures and tanks and all kinds of things that data centers need, must have. But it's the stuff you wouldn't necessarily think about. But where the data center market is going, this business is going. And that's all because of AI and also because of the what is going to be a constrained power grid.
I have a deal right now that we're prepping for market that's outsourced radiology departments, and they were smart to integrate AI early on. You know, I think radiology in general is a field within medicine that will be very disrupted by AI in the short term. And what's fun about this deal is that they're producing millions of studies a year. And so all of a sudden we can start to add a sector of potential buyers who's looking to train AI with radiology overreads. So what's fun about that company is that's probably not the initial value driver that they used to build this company just a couple of years ago, but it's become a valuable component of what we're bringing to market. And it's opened up a new category of potential buyers that we wouldn't have likely thought about before.
So what would you say is the ideal type of client that you want to work with?
I'd say ideally a transaction value would be 50 million to a billion or more. That's kind of our sweet spot. However, it's really hard to tie that to company size. You could have a company that's doing 5 or 10 million of revenue, but it's all subscription ARR, MRR, and that might get up into the 50 million plus range. So it's hard to tie company size to it, but it's just when we do our evaluation, do we feel we're going to be able to get a really good strategic outcome for the seller? And we believe we can bring strategic buyers where we will be able to get a premium. And then we'll try to find a situation that works well for the seller, for us, with our confidence going in, that we'll get a great outcome. So I like to take just about any and all introduction in meeting. And if it's not a fit, we'll say it's not a fit, or we guide you to do this or that. But that's typically the ideal client for us in the range that they would be in.
So as we get ready to wrap up here, I'd love for each of you to just share like one idea that you think is important for our listeners to understand and to walk away learning about from our conversation here today. Andy, why don't I start with you?
I'd say the biggest thing is that an exit process needs to be well planned for, both for the process itself, but also other things like estate planning, trust planning, financial planning, and all of that, getting your house in order. But largely, I think, you know, really having a coach, CEO Coaching International, have that person involved, and then tag teamed at the hip with a sell-side advisor. The sell-side advisor just makes such a big difference in getting, first of all, I think, significantly increasing the opportunity that the deal will get completed. And then secondly, helping to manage the due diligence, all the workflows, the emotional roller coaster that it goes through, and just helping get a really great outcome. And in our case, maximizing value while meeting those preferred and required outcomes. And I think there's also a lot of business owners where people are knocking on your door every day. And even if it's the buyer, the one that you just know, they're the one I want my business to be sold to. They've given me a number that's a good number. I don't need an advisor. I can just hire my lawyer to get this deal done. There's many, many, many cases where those deals don't end up happening. They blow up. And it's really good to have that advisor in place. And also, in that case, if you do want to run with one buyer or maybe a small handful of buyers, we would run that in terms of saying, hey, we're going to give you the opportunity to preempt a process. You look like you're the ideal buyer. We'll give you some information you need to come in with an offer. If it's compelling, our client is willing to go with you. But it's got to be compelling. Otherwise, we're going to run a process. The fact that we've been hired and named as the advisor sends a message to the buyer. The seller's serious. We really want this business. So let's give them a compelling offer. And there's a little bit of fear of missing out. And so we've created competitive tension, even when it's just with one buyer. And at the end of the day, if that outcome happens, the buyer's got what they want, the seller's got what they want, and we just got a really good strategic deal completed for both parties.
I'd love to hear a little bit about how you price your service. And you don't necessarily have to tell me the exact numbers, but is it a percentage of the transaction price? Do you have a retainer fee that you charge? Because if this deal does take 9 to 12 months or 24 months to do, are you guys getting paid at all along the way? How does that work?
We're very intentional about creating our fee table so that it is completely aligned with the success of our clients, which is that it is almost entirely based on success fee. And we design our fee table so there's, you know, a minimum that we've established, a minimum to get our clients to say yes, but where there's an opportunity for us to make incrementally more, the higher above that number we achieve. It's very clean and clear what winning looks like, and that's winning for our clients. We do charge a retainer. It's a small percentage of the cost that we invest in the deal as we prep for our in-market and bring it to close. And typically it's based on the enterprise value, you know, kind of the transaction size, what those percentages and what that retainer fee looks like. But in the end, you know, our clients should be thrilled to wire us that piece of money, you know, for that to come out, because what we've achieved is generally, it far exceeds what they thought would be possible with what they've built.
Excellent. All right. Well, Brenda, I'll give you your final thought that you want to
leave. Yeah, I would say that my final thought actually builds on Andy. This is all we do, right? We are singularly focused on sell side mandates for privately held businesses, and we're thrilled with the really to have the honor of representing our clients in what will likely be the most significant financial event for themselves, their families, and beyond. And so we take that very seriously and are often unlocking capital that our clients choose to do really amazing things within the world. You know, so we talked a lot about what can happen from unraveling the identity. I don't want to miss the opportunity to highlight how much great work is being done with the time, space, and the money, really, to leave a legacy in the world. We're always excited to see what our clients choose to do with what we've unlocked from what they've built.
And lastly, what's the best way for folks to reach out to you if they want to inquire about your services?
The best way for people to get in contact with us would be to email either one of us. My email is aharris, A-H-A-R-R-I-S, at stscapital.com.
And mine's B. Jacobsen, B-J-A-C-O-B-S-E-N, at stscapital.com.
Terrific. All right. Well, Brendan, Andy, appreciate you being on the show today. And again, if anyone has any questions or want to follow up, we've got the email addresses here. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Steve.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Now, I have a question for you. How are you going to implement and benefit from the ideas that you hear on our show? Well, we would love to have a conversation with you about that. So please visit us at ceocoachinginternational.com. We can then set up a call and we can talk about how we can help you make big happen in your business. Thanks, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you.